Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking a psychological spelunking trip.
That's a good way to put it.
We are plunging right into the mind's architecture, guided by the foundational work of Carl Jung, to explore the hidden blueprint of the self. Specifically, we are going deep on the shadow self.
Right. That complex and, you know, often really confusing part of our personality that influences pretty much everything we do.
Everything.
And this is so much more than just like an academic theory. This is a really pragmatic map for anyone who's into self-development, particularly for you, the listener, if you're struggling with those repetitive self-sabotaging patterns.
Or those emotional triggers that seem to come out of nowhere.
Exactly. Why do certain people just infuriate you? Or why do you find yourself falling short of your goals over and over again? Jungian psychology, it gives us a language and a structure, the persona, the ego, the shadow, and the self, to actually understand these things.
So we're kind of moving past the more common self-help tropes here.
Yeah, we're getting into the psychoanalytic foundation of who we are.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We're dealing with these big concepts, things like archetypes and the unconscious. And, you know, Jung's work can sometimes feel a little esoteric.
It can feel a bit out there, for sure, almost philosophical or spiritual.
Right. But its power, I think, is its ability to map onto human experience so, so accurately. It's an explanation not just of what we do, but why we're even capable of doing it.
That's the key.
So our mission today is to clearly define these psychic structures and then just conduct a massive, thorough, deep dive into the shadow, what it is, where it comes from, and probably most importantly, how we can integrate it to achieve some kind of psychological wholeness.
To even start, we're going to need a working model of the self. Mm. And the classic analogy that always comes up in Jungian thought, the iceberg, is just perfect for visualizing this.
Perfect for seeing where the conscious mind ends.
And where that vast, influential unconscious begins.
Okay, so let's start where everyone else starts.
Mm-hmm.
The part that shows up for work, for dinner parties, for social media. Let's talk about the persona.
The persona is the most superficial part, but it's also absolutely necessary. It is quite literally the social mask.
The tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. In the iceberg analogy, it's that small peak that sits entirely above the water, visible to everyone. It represents the role we adopt in the world. The student, the mentor, the professional, the parent.
It's the only part we feel like we have any real control over.
A true sense of conscious control, yeah. We choose the mask we present based on what's socially necessary, what's expected of us. It's really all about social compliance.
Okay. Now, right underneath that, but still sort of above the deepest part of the unconscious, is the ego. And this is a term that has been so corrupted by popular use.
Oh, completely.
We need to restore its proper Jungian function. When people say big ego, they usually mean something like narcissism or arrogance.
Which is a total misinterpretation of its function in analytical psychology. While we are highly aware of our ego, it's our conscious center, its simplest definition is that it's the psychic structure whose primary job is protection.
Protection.
The ego is the organizing principle of your consciousness. It's your sense of I or me. In the iceberg model, the ego is that big chunk of ice just below the waterline, still connected to the persona up top.
The hidden persona.
You could call it that.
Tata.
It's the self-identity you build based on your early conditioning and your experiences. It filters reality and protects the deepest core of the self from being overwhelmed or feeling vulnerable.
So the ego is basically a gatekeeper. It decides what information gets into our conscious awareness and which information might threaten the identity we've built for ourselves.
Precisely. It's a mechanism for survival and stability. It gives us a sense of coherence. But that protection is often based on illusion, which brings us to the next structure.
The self.
The self.
Yeah.
The totality of being. This one always feels like the hardest concept to really grasp. It feels more spiritual and psychological sometimes.
It does. And Jungians will admit that trying to translate the self into language kind of diminishes the actual profound, unified experience of it.
But psychologically speaking, the self is the organizing archetype of the entire psyche. It is you, stripped bare of the social mask, the persona, and the defensive structure, the ego, but also fully integrating the shadow.
So it's the whole picture.
The complete summation of all your circumstances, your personality, your experiences. In the iceberg analogy, the self is the entire system, the visible ice, the hidden ice, the water all around it, and even the sky above. It's the entity that unifies the conscious with the unconscious.
Which finally brings us to the shadow, the substance we are diving into today, that deep, dark water under the surface. If the ego is our conscious self-image, what exactly is the shadow in terms of both its function and, you know, what's in it?
The shadow is what we have actively rejected and repressed. It's the collection of all the aspects of our personality that the ego, often influenced by the persona and social conditioning, decided was unacceptable, shameful, or dangerous.
So it's the psychic trash bin.
In a way, these things get pushed down into our personal unconscious. Jung formally defined the shadow not just as a set of negative traits, but as a moral problem that challenges the whole ego personality.
A moral problem? Why does he call it that? That sounds intense.
Because recognizing the shadow requires a significant moral effort. It's not just realizing, oh, I sometimes get angry. It's recognizing that you are capable of the worst, most shameful aspects of human nature.
Wow.
It means confronting those aggressive impulses, the taboo mental images, the irrational wishes, and the unacceptable urges, the dark parts that fundamentally make us human. To recognize these as truly yours is the essential condition for any kind of self-knowledge. You have to admit the potential for evil or corruption lives inside you.
That immediately puts a wrench in the popular idea of just focusing on positive vibes and manifestation.
It really does. If you've ever had a flash of road rage or a genuinely violent thought that surprised and appalled you, and you immediately thought, no, that's not me, I'm a good person. That instantaneous rejection is the ego protecting its constructed identity from the shadow's contents. We refuse to identify with that aggression or that selfishness.
I think the analogy of the physical shadow really helps illustrate how unconscious this rejection is. It's cited in a lot of the sources.
It's a perfect metaphor. You don't consciously think of your physical shadow as you, but when you move, it moves. It exists because you are blocking the light.
Right, it's a part of you.
But more importantly, think about what happens when the light goes out. Even in the deepest dark, the shadow is still there. Tied intrinsically to your physical form, you just don't see it.
So it's always there, whether we're aware of it or not.
And that underscores the necessity of awareness. Without consciousness, we can be completely unaware that we are capable of becoming the twisted and evil people we judge everywhere else. The capacity for cruelty is universal.
So bringing this back to our development, if the persona is our social role and the ego is our protective identity, how does the shadow actually get formed? Why do we all bury these parts of ourselves?
The formation of the shadow is really rooted in social survival. It starts primarily in childhood, through parental and societal conditioning. As kids, we are entirely dependent on our caregivers for love and security.
Buzz.
So when we exhibit a trait that's deemed undesirable, anger, excessive sadness, aggression, maybe even ambition, we get a negative response, a withdrawal of love, a punishment or shame.
And we learned very, very quickly that if we want to gain that acceptance, we have to suppress certain natural, vital parts of who we are.
Precisely. We internalize those rules. We start to self-police, pushing those disallowed traits into the unconscious. The immediate consequences of crossing society's line are painful emotions like guilt and shame.
So to escape that pain, we just mask the flaw.
We mask the flaw using the ego and the persona. We create a rigid self-narrative of who we are, the good child, the smart one, the non-confrontational person, and we reject any information that contradicts that narrative.
Which just confirms the biases we already have about ourselves. We cling to what confirms our self-image.
And this is where the repression becomes so dangerous. Jung made a critical distinction here. If an inferiority or a trait is conscious, you have a chance to correct it, to modulate it, to integrate it with your other interests. It stays adaptable.
But if it's repressed?
If that trait is repressed and isolated from consciousness, locked away in the shadow, it never gets corrected. It just festers, maintaining its power and eventually demanding to be expressed.
So if the shadow isn't being corrected and it's just festering, is it just sitting there passively in the depths of our unconscious?
No, it's anything but passive. The repressed shadow is incredibly active. It doesn't disappear. It lives on in the unconscious, secretly controlling so much of what we say, believe, and crucially, what we do.
Which brings us to one of Jung's most powerful quotes, one that I think is so important. Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate.
That quote is absolutely crucial, especially for our audience. So many people navigating self-development feel stuck in these repetitive, painful cycles. They call it bad luck or fate.
All right. Why does this always happen to me?
When in reality, those cycles are often the result of unconscious impulses. That's shadow material that we failed to integrate. The shadow manifests in daily life in extremely disruptive ways when it demands expression.
Like what? What does that look like?
Think about those unexplained, sudden mood swings, or irrational fears that just paralyze you, or impulsive behaviors that seem to come from nowhere and totally shock your conscious mind. That's the ego losing control and the shadow acting out.
So it's basically acting as an autonomous force within our psyche.
Yes. If awareness remains repressed, the shadow archetype acts with autonomy and a possessive quality. It can completely overwhelm a person's actions. The sources note that the shadow can manifest as a gloomy mood, psychosomatic illness, or unconsciously provoked accidents.
Unconsciously provoked accidents.
Wow. A person possessed by their unintegrated shadow is, and this is a quote, always standing in his own light and falling into his own traps. They create the very problems they complain about because the ego is running on an illusion of control while the unconscious dictates reality.
It makes complete sense then why integrating the shadow has to be the critical first step in any kind of real psychological development.
Mm.
If you don't do this groundwork, you can't even see the deeper stuff.
Exactly. As Jung stated, without integrating the shadow, a deeper recognition of the anima and animus, the next stages we'll get to, is impossible. You can't start the journey toward wholeness if you are constantly at war with the darkness inside yourself.
And since confronting that darkness requires this massive moral effort, our psyche finds a very clever and highly destructive way to bypass that difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads us directly into the mechanism of projection.
Projection is how we externalize our darkness. We see our own rejected flaws and unacceptable content, our shadow in other people. Because seeing the shadow within ourselves is so difficult, so shameful, we magnify those same flaws in the external world.
So we reject the flaw inside.
And then we project it externally onto someone else. And by doing that, we maintain our self-identity of being good or right.
So if I, say, deeply hate someone's arrogance, the psychological mechanism here suggests that I am actually suppressing my own desire for or capacity for arrogance.
That is very often the case. It's a way of saying, I am not that. That belongs entirely to them. This self-deception is why the Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn famously observed that the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being.
Wow.
We avoid confronting the flaws in our own hearts by condemning those flaws, often very loudly, in others. It's so much easier to launch a moral crusade against an external figure than it is to acknowledge the mirror in front of us.
So what's the real danger of living like this, under this constant veil of projection?
The danger is living a life based on illusion. Projections insulate and delude us. They act as a constantly thickening veil between your ego and the real world. If that projection-making factor just runs rampant, you become entirely incapable of genuine relationship or clear self-assessment.
You stop seeing people as they actually are.
You only see your own repressed content reflected back at you. And this psychological lie, it prevents growth, and it condemns you to just repeat the same reactive cycles over and over again.
Let's get really concrete with these common shadow behaviors, because these are instantly recognizable to anyone navigating modern life, especially our self-help oriented listeners.
We can detail several prime examples of how the shadow acts out through projection. The first is that quick impulse to just harshly judge other people.
Right. Like criticizing a neighbor's life choices or judging someone's unconventional appearance.
Exactly. When you criticize someone's ridiculous outfit or their terrible taste, the subconscious maneuver is often rooted in fear. You might fear being singled out, or maybe you suppress your own unconventional creative impulses.
So by judging them?
By judging them, you reassure your ego that you are smart enough not to take that social risk, thereby defending your own anxiety about being judged yourself.
And the digital age has made the second one just ubiquitous, pointing out one's own insecurities as flaws in another person.
This is the fuel of online trolling. We see endless comments calling people idiots, uninformed, or talentless hacks. Jungian thought would argue that these trolls are often compensating for their own deep-seated feelings of inadequacy.
Hmm.
They attack the achievements or intelligence of others to lift themselves up, even if it's just for a moment in their own minds. The shadow self is exercising its aggressive impulses without any real-world consequences, all while protecting the persona of the good citizen.
Then there's the use of power in subordinate positions, which speaks to a feeling of helplessness.
This is the customer service aggression phenomenon. Why do people get so disproportionately angry with service workers who have very little power to retaliate?
Right.
Exercising power over someone in a subordinate position is the shadow's way of compensating for one's own intense feelings of helplessness against greater forces, whether that's a demanding boss, mounting debt, or a complicated bureaucracy.
Yeah.
They offload that stress onto the safest target available.
Another powerful example is the person who is constantly playing the victim.
Playing the victim is a very, very effective ego defense. Rather than admitting you did something wrong or taking responsibility, which is profoundly shameful to the ego, the person goes to extreme lengths to paint themselves as the innocent bystander.
So they protect the ego from the shame of being wrong.
By demanding pity and avoiding the moral confrontation with their own actions.
Let's talk about unacknowledged biases and prejudices. This is particularly relevant in today's social climate.
This is really challenging work because the social pressure to be non-prejudiced, not racist, not sexist, not xenophobic is so intense, many people find it easier to just pretend they don't harbor these destructive thoughts.
Rather than do the actual work.
Rather than do the deep, difficult internal work of overriding those ingrained stereotypes. The persona presents a perfectly woke face, but the shadow holds the destructive thoughts. And this creates a really deep internal schism.
And finally, the Messiah complex, or spiritual arrogance.
This is often a massive manifestation of the shadow disguised as enlightenment. The person believes they are so uniquely pure or enlightened that they can do no wrong. They construe all their actions, no matter how damaging they are, as being in service of saving other people.
Mm-hmm.
This intellectual or spiritual arrogance is the ultimate form of spiritual bypassing. It allows them to avoid confronting their own flaws while maintaining a position of moral superiority over everyone else.
These general examples are powerful, but this specific anecdote about the child running away really brings home how deeply ingrained this mechanism is, starting at such an early age.
It's so relatable. So recall the story. A narrator and their younger brother decide they're going to run away. They pack their essentials, and the narrator, the older sibling, urges the trusting little brother to jump out of the first story window first.
And the brother does it. He complies, landing behind a thorny hedge.
Right. And the narrator, who's now poised halfway out the window, experiences the sudden visceral awareness of the boundary being crossed on one side. Safety, rules, acceptance. On the other, massive, painful trouble.
And that is the ego, sensing the immediate danger to the persona.
That panic triggers an immediate survival-based retreat. The narrator pulls back, tells the brother they forgot something, and then rushes inside, not to grab an item.
But to tell on him.
To tell their mother that the brother was running away, the mother grounds the confused, betrayed brother, and the narrator becomes the savior who prevented the whole incident.
Let's analyze that critical psychological process right there, that moment of decision.
The fear of being wrong, the embarrassment, the guilt, that immediate pain was rejected by the ego. The ego of the big sister couldn't permit the admission of error. It would collapse her social status.
So to protect that identity.
She projected the deviant behavior onto the brother. She needed the shame and the punishment to be visible, but only for someone else.
And that act of betrayal was immediately rewarded by the ego with a dose of what's called psychic inflation. That feeling of moral superiority and relief for being right.
Precisely. That little boost of feeling like the good one, the responsible one, is the ego reinforcing the lie. This shows how easily we can go to extreme lengths to prove we are right, even if it means deeply wounding someone else. The shadow acted out to maintain the ego's illusion of perfection.
Okay, we've established that the shadow is the repository of everything we reject. We focus mostly on the dark, shameful, or aggressive stuff. But here's where the complexity deepens and where the real tragedy of the shadow lies.
Mm.
It is not purely negative.
That is the essential duality that is so often missed.
Yeah.
The shadow is defined simply as everything outside the light of consciousness, which means it can be positive or negative.
Positive.
Yes. Jung argued that the unconscious man, the shadow, does not consist only of morally reprehensible tendencies, but also displays a number of good qualities, such as normal instincts, appropriate reactions, realistic insights, and powerful creative impulses.
For our listeners who are struggling with low self-esteem, this is such a critical point. You may have rejected your strengths just as fiercely as you've rejected your flaws.
Absolutely. Think of people who can't accept compliments, or those who shy away from any form of healthy assertiveness or success. They have suppressed qualities like confidence, competence, or their own sexuality, because for one reason or another, these traits were deemed inappropriate or too dangerous to the ego's identity.
Maybe because success feels like it comes with too much responsibility or confidence invites judgment from others.
Exactly. And this brings us to the fascinating concept of the golden shadow.
The golden shadow?
The golden shadow is the aspect that contains those hidden gifts, talents, true vocations, and positive potentials that have been suppressed. And the profound irony here is that, as some Jungian practitioners suggest, integrating the truly negative shadow, the skeletons in the closet, can sometimes be easier than getting used to the gold of the shadow.
Why is that?
Yeah.
Why would it be harder to claim our genius than to admit our flaws?
Because often the acceptance of our potential feels overwhelming. If you admit you are truly creative or deeply talented, you also accept the responsibility that comes with those gifts.
Responsibility to use them.
The risk of failing publicly and the possibility of alienating those around you who might be envious. We reject these gifts out of fear of failure, fear of responsibility, or just a simple, deep-seated feeling of being unworthy or inadequate.
So we use the same mechanism we use for our negative traits. Projection.
Exactly. We see the gold in others and we project our latent qualities onto them, which keeps us safe from the fear of realizing that potential in ourselves.
We idolize a musician's creativity, a mentor's confidence, or a speaker's clarity.
And our ability to perceive and deeply appreciate these qualities actually reflects the innate potential that's residing within us. By projecting, we distance ourselves from these traits, rationalizing that they belong exclusively to that external figure, keeping them safely out of reach.
This sounds like a recipe for constant inadequacy and resentment. What is the total cost of not integrating the golden shadow?
The cost is enormous. It leads to this pervasive life dissatisfaction. First, there's self-sabotage, where we subconsciously hold ourselves back from success because the ego is terrified of the consequences of that power.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we become susceptible to codependency and dysfunctional relationships, constantly seeking outside validation or looking for the missing pieces in others, believing our own power resides in our partner or our leader.
And the most painful consequence.
Resentment. We get stuck in a perpetual state of feeling less than, bitter toward those onto whom we project our own light. The truth is, the gold is ours. And until we stop giving that power away to external figures or ideologies, we can never truly step into our authentic lives. Reclaiming the golden shadow is a non-negotiable step towards psychological wholeness.
This transition from being fragmented to integrated leads us directly to the central theme of Jungian psychology, individuation. So what is the ultimate goal of all this deep internal work?
Individuation is the process of going from a fragmented piece to a unique, whole individual. On a social level, it's about separating from the collective, you know, the unconscious, cultural norms, parental expectations, to become a distinct self-governing entity.
Psychologically, the aim is to divest the self of the false wrappings of the persona and the unconscious controlling influences of the archetypes.
It is the journey toward greater consciousness.
That's the goal.
Precisely. The goal is to bring what is unconscious into consciousness to achieve wholeness in the psyche. While Jung suggested this process ideally begins in the second half of life, he called it the inward turn, it's driven by the necessity of resolving the enormous tension and opposition between the conscious ego and the unconscious shadow. This is the path of maturation. It moves us beyond the illusion that we are fully conscious beings.
And this journey toward individuation, it's marked by developmental stages, right? With archetypes acting as guideposts, where does the shadow sit in this grand scheme?
The process starts with a necessary sequential confrontation of the major archetypes. Stage one is the shadow. This is the initial and critical step. Getting to know and integrating those disowned, repressed parts of ourselves, both the dark and the gold.
The apprentice piece.
Jung referred to it as the apprentice piece in an individual's psychological development. You have to do it first.
And once the apprentice piece is finished, what is the next great challenge?
Stage two is the animanimus. This is considered the masterpiece. It involves integrating the unconscious feminine aspect in a man, the anima, or the unconscious masculine aspect in a woman, the animus.
And that's harder.
Significantly more challenging than shadow integration because it deals not just with your personal repression, with the entire history of gender conditioning and the archetype of relationship itself, the soul image. Integrating the animanimus means achieving a greater balance of the opposites within your own psyche.
And stage three is the culmination, the final goal.
That is the realization of the self. This is the final archetype of wholeness and self-transcendence, often symbolized by the wise old man or wise old woman in mythology. The entire journey moves us from the narrow, fragmented ego to the totality of the self.
But you can't attempt the masterpiece until the apprentice piece, the shadow work, is complete.
You cannot.
So shadow work is the mandatory first step.
Yeah.
Conceptually, what exactly is shadow work and what is its goal?
Shadow work is the ongoing, difficult process of making the unconscious conscious. And it is vital to understand what it is not. It is not about defeating the shadow or transcending it or getting rid of it, as so many simplistic self-help modalities suggest.
Yeah.
Jung insisted the true aim is to integrate the shadow, to bring it into contact with the rest of the personality, to attain true wholeness or enlightenment.
So the goal isn't purity, it's completeness.
Exactly. And Jung provided a famous warning. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. The moment of integration is profoundly moral. It leads to self-acceptance, self-forgiveness, and, crucially, taking responsibility. Instead of grievance and blame, you own your flaws and your capacities. This expands your consciousness. It releases the immense energy you were previously spending fighting the shadow. And subjectively, it's experienced as a genuine revival of hope. You feel like you are finally living your own life.
Okay, for our audience who is actively seeking change, let's get into the practical techniques for integration. We need concrete ways to make the darkness conscious. So what do we do about it?
We can outline several methods accessible to the modern individual. The first is fundamental, self-reflection and emotional inquiry. This means developing a state of awareness, often through mindfulness or meditation, to observe your behavior patterns in real time.
So when you get triggered?
When you're triggered, the crucial step is to pause the reaction and apply conscious inquiry. Ask yourself, why am I reacting this way? Why is this particular person or this action pushing my buttons?
It's like emotional archaeology, right? You're backtracking the reaction to find the source, memory, or belief.
Precisely. You have to avoid justifying your actions after the fact. The power of this technique is cultivating an awareness of the shadow before the impulse leads to reactive behavior.
Okay. What else?
The second indispensable tool is journaling. This offers a safe, private space for emotional expression, where you can track patterns and explore your inner thoughts without the judgment of the persona.
Do you have any actionable journaling prompts that can help chip away at projection?
Absolutely. Prompts should focus on the externalized darkness and the unacknowledged gold. For example, list 5 traits you deeply dislike or judge in others. Now, how might those traits also be a suppressed part of you?
Oof, that's a tough one.
Or, conversely, who do you idolize? What specific quality in them do you wish you possessed? This practice starts chipping away at the foundation of projection and brings that shadow content closer to the ego.
The third method is considered the direct language of the unconscious. Dream analysis.
Dreams are the self's letters to the ego. They provide a direct, unfiltered connection to the shadow. In dreams, the shadow often appears in symbolic form, typically as a figure of the same sex as you, the dreamer. An enemy, a monster, or even a guide figure who has qualities that you lack.
So just writing them down is the first step.
Recording your dreams consistently, even if the meaning is totally unclear, helps build a necessary bridge between your unconscious and conscious mind, allowing the shadow material to surface.
And finally, the most advanced method, the one that requires the strongest ego, active imagination. This is where the real deep internal confrontation happens.
Active imagination is essentially engaging with unconscious images or complexes in a waking state. It is a rigorous dialectical procedure. It's a dialogue with your unconscious material. It involves focusing on psychic images that arise spontaneously, which could manifest as inner dialogue, visual scenes, art, or even movement.
And consciously interacting with them.
Right.
How does that differ from just, you know, guided meditation or daydreaming?
It differs because of the 4 crucial steps and the absolute requirement of moral confrontation. The process involves, first, clearing the ego's consciousness. You relax the protective defenses to allow the unconscious material to surface.
Okay.
Second, you let the fantasy image arise. You focus on a psychic image, a mood, or a dream figure that spontaneously enters your mind. Third, you give the image form. This means faithfully recording the material through writing, painting, sculpting, dancing, without censoring or rationalizing it.
And the 4th step is the key.
This is the key. Moral confrontation and dialogue. You have to bring your real ego, your true personality, to the confrontation. You must engage the inner figures, the shadow, for instance, as if they were real people in waking life, treating them with the moral seriousness they require.
And what's the risk of what you called psychic inflation if you don't use your real ego?
If you approach it with a fictive ego, pretending to be someone you aren't or using it as a purely intellectual escape, you jeopardize the whole process. Psychic inflation is when you identify too much with an archetype, feeling overwhelmed or possessed by its power.
So you could talk to the shadow and identify with its immense power.
And you might believe you are the next enlightened master, or worse, completely identify with its destructive qualities. This is why the final 5th step Applying the learning to concrete moral action in daily life is useless without the confrontation of the real self.
Given how intense this work is, we absolutely have to emphasize safety here.
Absolutely. For individuals dealing with deep-seated trauma, severe emotional instability, or conditions that risk psychosis, engaging in active imagination or deep dream work without professional guidance, ideally from a Jungian analyst or a trauma-informed therapist, is strongly advised against. The ego must be strong enough to contain the unconscious material without being shattered or overwhelmed.
Now that we've thoroughly covered the individual journey, let's widen the lens. If this massive internal work is being undertaken by individuals, what is the impact on the global community? Let's talk about the collective shadow.
The collective shadow is the repository of all the basest impulses that society as a whole represses. Greed, hatred, xenophobia, violence, primitive instinct. This collective darkness accrues over the course of history for entire social groups, nations, and humanity as a whole.
So the idea is that a toxic culture isn't just created by a few monstrous outliers, but by a collective of unconscious projecting individuals.
Precisely. When individuals project and act out their unconscious impulses on a mass scale, we see the macro scale danger emerge. This manifests as economic policies rooted in unfettered greed, regional conflicts, and most prominently, political polarization.
Yeah.
We project our collective worst qualities onto an enemy, another political party, another nation, another culture, to justify harm, discrimination, or simply ignoring their suffering.
It seems overwhelming. I mean, how can one person engaged in private shadow work possibly influence these colossal global problems?
This is the profound connection between the micro and the macro. Societies are made of individuals. When you heal and integrate your shadow, you stop living reactively, you stop projecting your flaws, and consequently, you stop hurting others less.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop blaming others for your problems, you build trust and stability in your immediate relationships. And this creates a powerful ripple effect of conscious behavior.
So doing this deep inner work is actually the opposite of being self-absorbed.
Yeah.
It's a fundamental act of civic and global responsibility.
It fosters genuine empathy and cooperation because you have recognized the capacity for both good and evil within yourself. You withdraw your projections, and in doing so, you become conscious of your own pretty thick shadow, as Jung put it. And he gave us the ultimate call to action on this point. The person who deals with his own shadow knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself. And if he only learns to deal with his own darkness, he has done something real for the world, shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic unsolved social problems of our day.
That reframes personal responsibility completely. We're not just seeking personal fulfillment. We're contributing to global health by striving to become less reactive, less judgmental, and more conscious citizens of the world.
Every conscious choice you make, kindness, cooperation, trust, is a conscious counterweight to the toxic culture built on mass projection. It all begins with the journey inward.
This has been an incredibly thorough deep dive into the shadow self. We started by mapping the self-defining, the social persona, the protective ego, and the unifying self before confronting the shadow, that reservoir of repressed dark and light.
We established that the shadow is formed through early conditioning, and when it's ignored, it dictates our lives, compelling us to project our deepest fears and flaws onto others, leading to cycles of self-sabotage and resentment.
We learned that the journey to self-realization, the process of individuation, requires us to confront and integrate the shadow first, that critical apprentice piece, before we can achieve the true wholeness symbolized by the self.
And that shadow work, using techniques like active imagination and dream analysis, is the path to achieving consciousness and escaping the confines of fate.
It is a continuous process of rigorous moral confrontation.
Mm-hmm. New shadow aspects will always emerge as we grow and change, demanding constant vigilance and integration, making the continuous journey the real goal.
Our discussion focused heavily on the moral necessity of integrating the shadow to shed reactivity and negativity. But we also spent time on the golden shadow, that repository of suppressed genius and creative potential.
The unconscious is often cited as the true seat of all creative ability. When we suppress our gifts out of fear, inadequacy, or responsibility, we project that genius outward, worshiping it in others.
So let's leave you with this final provocative thought for your own inner work. If the shadow is truly the source of repressed genius and creative impulses, and you are constantly admiring these qualities in others, in artists, mentors, or leaders, What specific unclaimed talent or vital creative impulse might your avoidance of the darker side of responsibility be currently suppressing in your everyday life?
What piece of gold are you convinced belongs to someone else when in reality it's the raw power you need to reclaim your full self?
Thank you for taking this deep dive with us.
We'll catch you on the next dive.